This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel like
thank you very much. Thank you, Peter. It is a delight to be here this evening on our penultimate evening of our two-week tour. It's been an exhilarating and exciting whirlwind of different universities and events, and we see the end in sight now. But we're glad that you've come out this evening to think about this most important question of who was Jesus. And after I share my prepared lecture, then we'll throw it open for your questions. So as I speak, be thinking of what question this might provoke in your own minds, and we'll have an opportunity to hear from you after the lecture is concluded. 20 centuries after his death, Jesus of Nazareth continues to fascinate thinking men and women. The number one bestseller for months on the New York Times bestseller list has been the Dan Brown novel, The Da Vinci Code, based upon a novel interpretation of the historical Jesus. Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, has grossed some $640 million to date. Just this past week, James Cameron has released a documentary film and a promised book based upon the claim that the family tomb of Jesus of Nazareth has been discovered by archaeologists. For centuries, Jesus of Nazareth has been the most influential person in the history of the human race, and he refuses to go away. But who was Jesus of Nazareth, really? Was he God incarnate, as Christians believe? Or was the historical Jesus, as many Jews believe, a typical Jewish holy man? Or are Muslims correct in thinking him to have been no more than a human prophet sent by God? Or could certain contemporary radical critics be right, that Jesus was a sort of social gadfly, the Jewish equivalent of a Greek cynic philosopher? Well, perhaps the best way to get at these questions is to ask what Jesus thought about himself. After all, if you want to know who somebody is, the logical place to start is to ask him who he thinks himself to be. Who did Jesus think he was? Now, immediately we confront a problem. Since Jesus himself did not leave behind any writings of his own, we're dependent upon the records of others for what Jesus said and did. Now, this situation isn't unusual for figures of antiquity. For example, the famous Greek philosopher Socrates also left behind no writings of his own. We're dependent upon his disciple, Plato, for most of our knowledge of Socrates' life and teaching. In the same way, we're dependent upon the records of Jesus' followers for his life and teaching. But while this situation isn't unusual, it does occasion the question, how do we know that these records are accurate? Maybe Jesus' followers said that he said and did certain things, which he really didn't. In particular, since the early Christians believed that Jesus was God, maybe sayings and stories to that effect evolved and were ascribed to the historical Jesus. So we shouldn't be surprised that Jesus in the Gospels makes claims and does things implying his divinity. Maybe the historical Jesus who really lived was quite different than the figure that we read about in the Gospels. How can we tell if these records are historically accurate? Well, up until the modern era, questions like this remained basically unanswerable. But with the rise of modern historiography during the Renaissance and the rise of the science of textual criticism, historical scholars began to develop the tools to unlock these questions. Jesus is no longer just a figure in a stained glass window, but a real flesh and blood person of history, just like Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great, whose life can be investigated by the normal methods of history. The writings contained in the New Testament can be scrutinized by the same historical criteria that we use in investigating other sources for ancient history, such as Thucydides' Peloponnesian War or the Annals of Tacitus. Now, the first thing that we need to do in order to conduct a historical investigation of Jesus is to assemble our sources. Jesus of Nazareth is referred to in a range of ancient sources, both inside and outside the New Testament, including Christian, Roman, and Jewish sources. Now, this is really quite extraordinary when you think of how relatively obscure a figure Jesus of Nazareth was. He had at most a 3-year public life as an itinerant Galilean preacher in what we call today Palestine. We have far more information about Jesus of Nazareth than we do for many major figures of antiquity. The most important of these historical sources have been collected into the New Testament. References to Jesus outside the New Testament tend to confirm what we read in the Gospels, but they don't really tell us anything new. Therefore, the focus of our investigation must be upon the documents collected into the New Testament. Now, I find that many students and laymen don't understand this procedure. They think that if you examine the New Testament writings themselves, rather than look at sources outside the New Testament, then somehow you're reasoning in a circle, quoting the Bible to prove the Bible. If you even quote a passage out of the New Testament, they think that somehow you're begging the question, presupposing that the New Testament is reliable. But that's not at all what historians do when they examine the documents of the New Testament. They're not treating the Bible as a wholly inspired book and trying to prove that it's true by quoting it. Rather, they're treating the documents of the New Testament like any other collection of ancient documents and investigating whether they're historically reliable. It's important to keep in mind that originally there wasn't any such book called the New Testament. There were just separate documents handed down from the first century, things like the Gospel according to Luke, the Gospel according to John, the Acts of the Apostles, Paul's letter to the church in Corinth, Greece, and so on and so forth. It wasn't until a couple of centuries later that the church officially collected these various documents together, put them under one cover, and called it the New Testament. The church only included the sources for the New Testament which were closest to Jesus and the original disciples, and they simply left out the later secondary sources like these forged apocryphal gospels, which everyone knew were fakes. So, from the very nature of the case, the best historical sources were collected into the New Testament. People who insist on looking at evidence taken only from sources outside the New Testament thus don't understand what they're inviting us to do. They're demanding that we ignore the earliest primary documents about Jesus in favor of sources which are later, secondary, and less reliable, which is just mad as historical methodology. Now, this is important because all of the radical reconstructions of the historical Jesus that you read about in the newspaper and see on television today are based on later writings outside the New Testament, in particular the so-called apocryphal gospels. Well, now, what are the apocryphal gospels? These are gospels that were forged under the apostles' names. Things like the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Philip, and so on and so forth. They first began to appear in the second half of the second century after Christ. Revisionists claim that these extra-biblical writings are the key to correctly reconstructing the historical Jesus. Professor Luke Johnson, who is a distinguished professor of New Testament studies at Emory University, points out that all of the recent spate of books claiming to reveal the real Jesus follow the same predictable pattern. It goes like this. Number one, the book begins by trumpeting the scholarly credentials of the author and his prodigious research. Two, the author claims to offer some new and maybe even suppressed interpretation of who Jesus really was. Three, the truth about Jesus is said to be discovered by means of sources outside the New Testament, which enable us to read the Gospels in a new way, which is at odds with their face value meaning. Four, this new interpretation is provocative and maybe even titillating. For example, that Jesus married Mary Magdalene, or was the leader of a hallucinogenic cult, or was a peasant cynic philosopher. And finally, number five, it is implied that traditional Christian beliefs are therefore undermined and need to be revised. Now, if you hear of books following this familiar five-point pattern, then your critical antennae ought to go immediately up. You are about to be duped. For the fact of the matter is that there is no source outside the New Testament which calls into question the portrait of Jesus painted in the Gospels. In the words of John Meyer, a prominent American New Testament critic, the idea that the apocryphal Gospels offer us new information about Jesus is, and I quote, largely fantasy. The fact is that these are writings which are later derivative writings shaped by the theology of the second century and later. What this means, in the words of Professor Johnson, is that despite all the hoopla, the writings of the New Testament remain our best historical witnesses to the life of Jesus. So, try not to think of the New Testament as a single book. Rather, try to think of it as what it originally was, just a bunch of documents written in the Greek language, handed down to us out of the first century, telling this remarkable story about a man named Jesus from Nazareth. And the question then must be, how historically reliable are these documents? Here we confront the very crucial question of the burden of proof. Should we assume that the Gospels are reliable unless they are proven to be unreliable? Or should we assume that the Gospels are unreliable unless and until they are proven to be reliable? Are they innocent until proven guilty? Or are they guilty until proven innocent? Skeptical scholars almost always assume that the Gospels are guilty until proven innocent. That is to say, they assume that the Gospels are unreliable unless and until they are proven to be correct on some particular fact or point. And I'm not exaggerating here. This really is the modus operandi of skeptical critics. I want to list, however, five reasons why I think it would be historically unjustified to assume that the Gospels are unreliable until proven correct. Number one, there was insufficient time for legendary influences to expunge the historical facts. Sometimes laymen will say, well, how can you know anything about what happened 2,000 years ago? What they fail to understand is that the crucial time gap is not the gap between the evidence and today. Rather, what is important is the gap between the evidence and the original events that the evidence is about. If the gap between the events and the evidence is short, then it doesn't matter how much the events and the evidence are from the present moment. Good evidence doesn't become poor evidence just by the passage of time, by receding into the past. So long as the time gap between the event and the evidence for that event is short, it's just irrelevant how long it has been until the present day. The question then is how close the sources for Jesus' life are to the time he lived. And I'll say something more about that in a minute. Number two, the Gospels are not analogous to folk tales or contemporary urban legends. Tales like those of King Arthur or Robin Hood and his Merry Men, or contemporary urban legends like the Vanishing Hitchhiker, rarely concern actual historical individuals and are thus not analogous to the gospel narratives. In the case of legends like Robin Hood and so forth, there may have been originally an historical individual who met the description, but the legends have taken centuries since then to accrue and come to be. Number three, the Jewish transmission of sacred traditions was highly developed and reliable. In an oral culture like that of first century Palestine, the ability to memorize and retain large tracts of oral tradition was a highly prized and highly developed skill. From the earliest age, children in the home, in elementary school, and in the synagogue were taught to memorize faithfully sacred tradition. The disciples of Jesus would have exercised similar care with Jesus' teachings. Fourthly, there were significant restraints on the embellishment of traditions about Jesus, such as the presence of eyewitnesses and the apostles' supervision. Since those who had seen and heard Jesus continued to live, and the tradition about Jesus remained under the supervision of the apostles, these factors would act as a natural check on tendencies to elaborate the facts in a direction contrary to that preserved by those who had known and lived with Jesus. And finally, number five, the gospel records, or the gospel writers, rather, have a proven track record of historical reliability. Now, I don't have enough time to go into all five of these, but let me say something more about the first and the fifth points. Remember that first point was that there was insufficient time for legendary influences to expunge the historical facts. No modern scholar thinks of the Gospels as bald-faced lies, the result of a massive conspiracy. I perhaps need to alter that statement in light of my debate with James Crossley at Sheffield just the other night. He does seem to attribute these Gospels, in many cases, to creative story writing. But typically, the place where that kind of conspiracy theory is laid out is in sensationalist popular literature or in former propaganda from behind the Iron Curtain. When you read the pages of the New Testament, there's no doubt that these people sincerely believed in the truth of what they proclaimed. Rather, ever since the 19th century, skeptical scholars have tried to explain away the Gospels as legends, not deliberate lies, but rather legends, like the child's game of telephone. As the stories about Jesus were passed on over the decades, they got muddled and exaggerated and mythologized until the original facts were all but lost. The Jewish peasant sage was transformed into the divine Son of God. One of the major problems with the legend hypothesis, however, which is almost never addressed by skeptical critics, is that the time gap between Jesus' death and the writings of the Gospels is just too short for this to happen. This point has been well explained by Professor A.N. Sherwin White in his book, Roman Society and Roman Law in the New Testament. Now, Professor Sherwin White is not a theologian. He is a professional Greco-Roman historian of the era prior to and contemporaneous with Jesus of Nazareth. According to Professor Sherwin White, the sources for Roman and Greek history are usually biased and usually removed one or two centuries or generations from the events that they record. And yet, he says, historians reconstruct with confidence the course of Roman and Greek history. For example, the earliest biographies of Alexander the Great were written by Arrian and Plutarch about 400 years or more after Alexander's death. And yet classical historians still consider them to be trustworthy. The fabulous legends about Alexander did not develop until during the centuries after these two writers. According to Professor Sherwin White, the writings of Herodotus enable us to determine the rate at which legend accumulates. And the tests show that even two generations is too short a time span to allow legendary tendencies to wipe out the hard core of historical facts. So when Professor Sherwin White turns to the Gospels, he states that for the Gospels to be, in their core, legends, the rate of legendary accumulation would have to be, and I quote, unbelievable. More generations would be needed. In fact, adding a time gap of two generations to Jesus' death lands you in the second century, just when the apocryphal Gospels first begin to appear. And these do contain all sorts of fabulous stories about Jesus, trying to fill in the years between his boyhood and the commencement of his ministry, for example. And I think these are far better candidates for the office of legendary fiction than the biblical Gospels. This point becomes even more devastating for skepticism when we realize that the Gospels themselves use sources that go back even closer to the events of Jesus' life. For example, the story of Jesus' suffering and death, commonly called the Passion story, was probably not originally written by Mark. Rather, Mark, our earliest Gospel writer, used a source for this narrative. Now, since Mark is the earliest Gospel, his source must be even earlier. In fact, Rudolf Pesch, a German commentator on Mark, says that this Passion source must be dated no later than A.D. 37. That is just 7 years after Jesus' death. Or again, to give another example, Paul, in his letters, hands on information about Jesus concerning his teaching, his Last Supper, his betrayal, his crucifixion, burial, and resurrection appearances. Paul's letters were written even before the Gospels, and some of his information, for example, what he passes on in his first letter to the church in Corinth about the resurrection appearances of Jesus, has been dated to within 5 years, and sometimes within months of Jesus' death. And it just becomes irresponsible to speak of legends in cases like these. That fifth point, you remember, was that the Gospel writers have a proven track record of historical reliability. Now, again, I have time to look at only one example, Luke. Luke was the author of a two-part work, the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles. These are really one work, and they're separated in our Bible simply because the church grouped the Gospels together in the New Testament. Luke is the gospel writer who writes most self-consciously as a historian. In the prologue to his gospel, he begins with the following words. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught. Now, this preface is written in classical Greek, such as was used by the Greek historians. After this, Luke lapses into a more common or vulgar Greek, but he has put his reader on notice that he can write, should he wish to, in the style of the learned Greek historian. He speaks in his preface of his lengthy investigation into the story he's about to tell. He assures us that it is based on eyewitness testimony and is accordingly the truth. Now, who was this author that we call Luke? He was clearly not himself an eyewitness to Jesus' life, since he wrote on the basis of eyewitness accounts. But we discover an important fact about him from the book of Acts. Beginning in the 16th chapter of Acts, when Paul reaches Troas in modern-day Turkey, the author suddenly starts using the first person plural. We set sail from Troas to Samothrace. We remained in Philippi for some days, as we were going to the place of prayer, and so on and so forth. The most obvious explanation for this switch is that the author had joined Paul's entourage on his evangelistic tour of the Mediterranean cities. In chapter 21, he accompanies Paul back to Palestine and finally to Jerusalem. What this means is that the author of Luke Acts was in fact in first-hand contact with eyewitnesses of Jesus' life and ministry in Jerusalem. Now, skeptical critics have done backflips to try to avoid this conclusion. They say that the first person plural in the book of Acts shouldn't be taken literally. It's just a literary device which was common in ancient sea voyage stories. Never mind that many of the passages in the book of Acts are not about Paul's sea voyage, but take place on land. The more important point is that this theory, when you check it out, turns out to be sheer fantasy. There just is no ancient literary device of sea voyages related in the first person plural. The whole thing has been shown to be a scholarly fiction. There is no avoiding the conclusion, I think, that Luke Acts was written by a traveling companion of Paul who had the opportunity to interview eyewitnesses to Jesus' life while in Jerusalem. Who were some of these eyewitnesses? Well, perhaps we can get some clue by subtracting from the Gospel of Luke everything found in the other Gospels and seeing what is peculiar to Luke. When you do this, what you discover is that many of Luke's peculiar narratives are connected to women who followed Jesus, people like Joanna and Susanna, and significantly, Mary, Jesus' mother. Well, was this author reliable in getting his facts straight? The book of Acts enables us to answer that question decisively. The book of Acts overlaps significantly with the secular history of the ancient world. And the historical accuracy of Acts is indisputable. This has recently been demonstrated anew by Colin Hemer, a classical scholar who turned to New Testament studies, in his book, The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History. Hemer goes through the book of Acts with a fine-toothed comb, pulling out a wealth of historical detail, ranging from what would have been common knowledge to anyone in the ancient world, down to details which only a local person could know. And again and again and again, Luke's accuracy is demonstrated. From the sailings of the Alexandrian corn fleet out of Egypt, to the coastal terrain of the islands, to the peculiar and shifting titles of the local officials, Luke gets it right. According to Professor Sherwin White, the confirmation of historicity in Acts is overwhelming. Any attempt to reject its historicity, even in matters of detail, must now appear absurd. The judgment of Sir William Ramsay, a world-famous archaeologist, still stands. He said, "Luke is a historian of the first rank. This author should be placed among the very greatest of historians." Given Luke's care and demonstrated reliability, as well as his contact with eyewitnesses within the first generation after the events, this author is trustworthy. On the basis of these five reasons, then, that I've listed, I personally think that we should assume that the Gospels are reliable in what they say about Jesus unless they are proven to be wrong. But in any case, at the very least, we cannot assume that they are wrong until they are proven to be right. We should at least adopt a position of neutrality. Now, by the very nature of the case, it will be impossible to say a whole lot more beyond this to prove that certain stories in the Gospels are historically true. How could you prove, for example, the story of Jesus visiting Mary and Martha? You just have here a story told by a reliable author in a position to know, and no reason to doubt the historicity of the story. There's not a whole lot more to be said. Nevertheless, for many of the key events in the Gospels, a great deal more can be said. So what I'd like to do now is to take some of the important aspects of Jesus in the Gospels and say a word about their historical credibility. Number one, Jesus' radical self-concept as the divine Son of God and Son of Man. Radical critics deny that Jesus of Nazareth thought of himself as the divine Son of God or Son of Man. They say that after Jesus' death, the early church claimed that he had said these things, even though he really hadn't. The fundamental problem with this hypothesis is that it then becomes inexplicable how monotheistic Jews could have attributed divinity to a man whom they had accompanied during his lifetime if he never claimed any such things about himself. Monotheism lay at the very heart of the Jewish religion, and it would have been blasphemous to say that a human being was God. Yet this is precisely what the earliest Christians did proclaim and believe about Jesus. Such a claim must have been rooted in Jesus' own teaching and self-understanding. And in fact, the majority of scholars do believe that among the historically authentic words of Jesus are claims that reveal his divine self-understanding. Now, one could give a whole lecture on this topic alone, but let me just focus on Jesus' self-concept of being the divine Son of God and the Son of Man. Jesus' radical self-understanding as God's unique Son is revealed in his parable of the wicked tenants of the vineyard. This is found in Mark chapter 12, verses 1 to 8. This is the parable. "He then began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall around it, dug a pit for the winepress, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and went away on a journey. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He sent still another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He set him last of all, saying, they will respect my son. But the tenants said to one another, this is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours. So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. Now, in this parable, the owner of the vineyard represents God. The vineyard symbolizes Israel. The tenants are the Jewish religious leaders, and the servants sent by the owner of the vineyard are the prophets sent by God to Israel. And the tenants beat and reject the owner's servants. The owner finally says, I have one left to send, my only beloved son. They will listen to him. But instead, as we saw, the tenants or the religious leaders kill the son because he is the heir to the vineyard. Now, what does this parable tell us about Jesus' self-understanding? It tells us that he thought of himself as God's special son, distinct from all the prophets, God's final messenger, and even the heir to Israel itself. This is no mere Jewish peasant. Jesus' self-concept as God's son comes to explicit expression in Matthew chapter 11 and verse 27. Jesus says, all things have been delivered to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son chooses to reveal him. Now, again, there's good reason to regard this as an authentic saying of the historical Jesus. It's drawn from an old source, which was shared by Matthew and Luke, which scholars call the Q document. Moreover, it's unlikely that the church invented this saying because it says that the Son is unknowable. Jesus says, no one knows the Son except the Father. But for the post-Easter church, we can know the Son. So the saying isn't the product of later church theology. But what does this saying then tell us about Jesus' self-concept? It tells us that he thought of himself as the exclusive and absolute Son of God and the only revelation of God the Father to mankind. Make no mistake, if Jesus was not who he claimed to be, then he was crazier than Jim Jones and David Koresh put together. Finally, I want to look at one more saying, the saying at his trial on his identity as the coming Son of Man. But before I read that passage, I want to read a prophecy from the Old Testament book of Daniel, chapter 7, verses 13 and following. This is a description of a vision had by the prophet Daniel. He said, in my vision at night, I looked, and behold, there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, that is God, and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Now, fast forward to Jesus' trial before the Jewish Sanhedrin, in which they are trying to find a charge on which to sentence Jesus to death. In the trial scene described in Mark chapter 14, verse 60 and following, we read this account. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, that is to say the Messiah? Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One, that is God? Are you the Messiah, the Son of God? I am, said Jesus, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. The high priest tore his clothes, Why do we need any more witnesses, he asked. You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. Here Jesus claims not only to be the Messiah and the Son of God, but in a virtual quotation from Daniel's prophecy in Daniel 7, he claims to be the Son of Man, seated at the right hand of God and coming on the clouds in judgment. And therefore, the Sanhedrin counts him guilty of blasphemy and sentences him to death. Now, this is really incredible stuff. And yet, this is what the historical Jesus believed about himself. And this is only one facet of Jesus' self-understanding. C.S. Lewis was right when he said, a man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level of a man who says he is a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. Secondly, Jesus' miracles. Even the most skeptical critics cannot deny that the historical Jesus carried out a ministry of miracle working and exorcisms. Rudolf Bultmann, who was one of the most radical, skeptical scholars of the 20th century, wrote back in 1926 the following. Most of the miracle stories contained in the Gospels are legendary, or at least are dressed up with legends. But, there can be no doubt that Jesus did such deeds, which were, in his and his contemporaries' understanding, miracles. That is, deeds that were the result of supernatural, divine causality. Doubtless, he healed the sick and cast out demons. End quote. Back in Bultmann's day, the miracle stories were thought to be influenced by stories of mythological heroes in Greco-Roman religion, and hence at least in part legendary. But today it is widely recognized that the hypothesis of mythological influence was simply historically incorrect. Craig Evans, who is a well-known Jesus scholar, says that the older notion that the miracle stories were the product of mythological divine man ideas has been largely abandoned. He says it is no longer seriously contested that miracles played a role in Jesus' ministry. The only reason left for denying that Jesus of Nazareth performed actual miracles is the presupposition of anti-supernaturalism. That is to say that miracles do not happen. And that is not a historical consideration. That is a philosophical position which is independent of the evidence. Number three, Jesus' trial and crucifixion. According to the Gospels, Jesus was condemned by the Jewish High Court on the charge of blasphemy and then delivered to the Romans for execution for the treasonous act of setting himself up as the king of the Jews. Not only are these facts confirmed by independent biblical sources like the letters of Paul and the Acts of the Apostles, but they are also confirmed by extra-biblical sources. From Josephus and Tacitus, we learn that Jesus was crucified by Roman authority under the sentence of Pontius Pilate. From Josephus and Mara bar Serapion, we learn that the Jewish leaders made a formal accusation against Jesus and participated in the events leading up to his crucifixion. And from the Babylonian Talmud, Sanhedrin 43a, we learn that Jewish involvement in the trial was explained as a proper undertaking against a heretic. According to Luke Johnson, the support for the mode of his death, its agents, and perhaps its co-agents, is overwhelming. Jesus faced a trial before his death, was condemned, and executed by crucifixion. The crucifixion of Jesus is thus recognized even by radical critics, such as those in the so-called Jesus Seminar, as, in the words of Robert Funk, the chairman of the seminar, the one indisputable fact about Jesus. But that raises the very puzzling question, why was Jesus crucified? As we've seen, the evidence indicates that his crucifixion was instigated by his blasphemous claims, which to Roman ears would come across as treasonous. That's why he was crucified, in the words of the plaque nailed to the cross above his head, as the King of the Jews. But if Jesus was just a peasant Jewish cynic, just a liberal social gadfly, then his crucifixion becomes inexplicable. As Professor Leander Keck of Yale University has written, the idea that this Jewish cynic and his dozen hippies, with his demeanor and aphorisms, was a serious threat to society sounds more like a conceit of alienated academics than sound historical judgment. John Meyer is equally direct. He says such a Jesus would threaten no one, just as the university professors who create him threaten no one. Skeptical critics have thus created a Jesus who is incompatible with the one indisputable fact about him, namely his crucifixion. Finally, number four, Jesus' resurrection. Most people would say that the resurrection of Jesus is something you just believe in by faith or not. But in fact, there are four established facts recognized by the majority of New Testament critics who have written on the subject, which I believe are best explained by the resurrection of Jesus. Fact number one, after his crucifixion, Jesus' corpse was laid in a tomb by Joseph of Arimathea. This fact is highly significant because it means that the location of Jesus' tomb was known to Jew and Christian alike in Jerusalem. Joseph was a member of the Sanhedrin which had condemned Jesus to the cross, and he is the person who was responsible for Jesus' interment in the tomb. But in that case, it becomes inexplicable how belief in his resurrection could arise and flourish in Jerusalem in the face of a tomb containing his corpse. According to the late John A.T. Robinson of Cambridge University, the honorable burial of Jesus in the tomb is one of the earliest and best attested facts about Jesus. Fact number two, on the Sunday morning following his crucifixion, the tomb of Jesus was found empty by a group of his women followers. According to Jakob Kramer, who is an Austrian specialist on the resurrection, and I quote, "By far most exegetes hold firmly to the reliability of the biblical statements about the empty tomb. As D.H. Van Dalen points out, it is extremely difficult to object to the empty tomb on historical grounds. Those who deny it," he says, "do so on the basis of theological or philosophical assumptions." Fact number three, on multiple occasions and under various circumstances, different individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive from the dead. This is a fact which is almost universally acknowledged among New Testament scholars today. Even Gert Ludemann, who is perhaps the most prominent current critic of the resurrection, admits, and I quote, "It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ." Finally, fact number four, the original disciples believed that Jesus was risen from the dead despite their having every predisposition to the contrary. Despite every predisposition to the opposite, it is an undeniable fact of history that the original disciples believed in, proclaimed, and were willing to go to their deaths for the fact of Jesus' resurrection. This despite the fact that ancient Judaism knew nothing of the idea of a Messiah who instead of triumphing over Israel's enemies would be humiliatingly executed by them as a criminal, much less was there any idea of Messiah rising from the dead. C.F.D. Moll of Cambridge University concludes that we have here a belief which nothing in terms of prior historical influences can account for apart from the resurrection itself. Any responsible historian, then, who seeks to give an account of the matter must deal with these four independently established facts: the honorable burial of Jesus, the discovery of his empty tomb, his post-mortem appearances, and the very origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection, and therefore the origin of Christianity itself. And I want to emphasize that these four facts represent not the conclusions of conservative scholars, but rather the majority of New Testament critics today. The question is then, how do you best explain these facts? Well, this puts the skeptical critic in a somewhat desperate situation. For example, I had a debate a few years ago with a professor at the University of California, Irvine, on the historicity of Jesus' resurrection. This man had written his doctoral dissertation on the subject and was thoroughly familiar with the evidence. He could not deny the facts of Jesus' honorable burial, his empty tomb, his post-mortem appearances, or the origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection. And therefore, his only recourse was to come up with some alternative explanation of these four facts. And so, he argued that Jesus of Nazareth must have had an unknown identical twin brother who was separated from him at birth and grew up unknown to everybody else independently in another city, who happened to come back to Jerusalem just at the time of the crucifixion, stole Jesus' body out of the tomb and presented himself to the disciples who mistakenly thought Jesus was risen from the dead. Now, I won't go into how I went about refuting this theory, but I think that the example is instructive because it shows to what desperate lengths skepticism must go in order to explain away the historicity of Jesus' resurrection. In fact, did you know that the evidence is so compelling that one of the world's leading Jewish theologians, the late Pincus Lapid, who taught at Hebrew University in Tel Aviv, declared himself convinced, on the basis of the evidence, that the God of Israel raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. So in summary, the Gospels are not only trustworthy documents in general, but when we look at some of the most important aspects of Jesus in the Gospels, like his radical personal claims, his miracles, his trial and crucifixion, and his resurrection from the dead, their historical veracity shines through. God has acted in history, and we can know it. Well, that concludes the lecture that I have prepared, and so now I'm interested in hearing from you and would invite you to pose any questions that you might like to pose. Yes, this fellow here in the black. All right, I'm going to repeat the question so others can hear it and also for the sake of the tape. The question was, aren't very large portions of the New Testament written by relatively few writers, and isn't that in some way troublesome? Well, it's certainly true that the Apostle Paul and his correspondence compose a large part of the New Testament. That's certainly very true. But when you think that we have four different biographies of the life of Jesus, this is extraordinary for such a relatively obscure figure. We would count ourselves fortunate to have one biography, one ancient biography, of a major figure in history. And yet here are four independent sources for the life of Jesus. Now, you rightly point out that Matthew and Luke knew Mark's gospel. Luke mentions in his preface that many have taken to compile an account, so he's aware of these previous accounts, and they may have drawn upon this sayings source called Q. But nevertheless, a comparison of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, will show that Matthew and Luke also had independent sources other than Mark for the information about Jesus. And this is particularly the case with regard to the burial and empty tomb story and resurrection appearances. It's very clear there that Matthew and Luke have sources in addition to Mark. And then John, of course, is independent of those other three. And then you've got the letters of Paul also handing on various information independently. So I think really what's surprising is not that a large part of the New Testament was written by, say, Paul and by Luke, but rather it is the multiplicity of sources that we have for Jesus that really stands out as quite extraordinary for other figures of ancient history. Yes, up in the back. All right, the question was about the textual purity of the Bible and the need for new translations. There are two reasons for the need of new translations. One will be purely linguistic, that is to say, forms of expression change and need to be updated. One of the most current examples would be trying to have gender-neutral translations, where instead of saying, for example, that God loves all men, to say God loves all people, the word man or men in the original Greek doesn't mean males. It means everybody, all people. And so in a culture such as Western society today, which is more sensitive to gender issues, the translation that God loves all people would be a more accurate rendering than God loves all men, lest that suggests that he only loves males. Or again, in the King James Version of the Bible, which you mentioned, there are many antiquated expressions that we no longer use in English. For example, it will talk about let your conversation be pure. And by conversation, that doesn't mean how you talk to other people. Conversation in Elizabethan English meant your mode of life, how you live. And so that will be translated differently. Or the King James will talk about the bowels of compassion. In the Hebrew thought, the seat of compassion was the kidneys. But we would normally say heart in our modern-day English. You feel compassion in your heart rather than your kidneys. So there's need for updating in terms of idiom and linguistics. But as well, there is the important factor that you mentioned, that better and better manuscripts of the New Testament are being found, which enable us to determine more and more accurately what the original documents actually said. So that far from representing an absence of confidence in the New Testament, these advances should increase our confidence in the text of the New Testament that we have today, because we now have far older and far better manuscripts than they did in 1611 when the King James Version of the Bible was translated. And in fact, out of the 138,000 words contained in the New Testament, only about 1,400 are still in doubt. That is about 1% of the text. So the text has been established to 99% accuracy. And that 1% that remains uncertain are words that have no material effect upon the Christian doctrine or the truth of the Christian religion. For example, in 1 John, one textual variant would say, "We write this that your joy may be full." And another variant says, "We write this that our joy may be full." The difference is just completely trivial, and that is typical of this 1% that remains still in dispute. So with 99% accuracy, we have the New Testament in Greek as Paul wrote it, as Luke wrote it, as the author of the Gospel of John wrote it. So we can have tremendous confidence that as we read the Greek text of the New Testament, we are dealing with the text as it was originally written. Now, if you contrast this with other texts in ancient history, the text of the New Testament stands head and shoulders above them. The New Testament is the best attested book in ancient history, both in terms of the number of manuscripts and in terms of the nearness of those manuscripts to the date of the original. Contrast, for example, the Quran in this respect. The oldest manuscripts we have of the Quran are from 100 or more years later than the original, and these texts are written in a type of script called the Kufic script, which did not exist at the time of Muhammad. Recently, there has been a cache of Qurans discovered in an attic of a mosque in Yemen, which are written in an earlier script, a Hijazi script, which is a 7th century script, which is earlier than the Kufic script upon which modern translations of the Quran are based. And significantly, these Qurans contain significant differences than modern Qurans. It has different ordering of the verses, there are different words, there are omissions, and this has caused a great stir among Islamic scholars in trying to reconstruct the original text of what the Quran said. Moreover, there are epigraphs of Quranic sayings in, for example, the Dome of the Rock, which is 7th century, as well as in petroglyphs or inscriptions in the Arabian Peninsula, and these also contain earlier, different wordings than the text of the Quran that we have today. So in contrast to the New Testament, the Quran's text is greatly in doubt. In fact, Gerd Puin, who is a German Islamicist and studies the Quran, says that about 20% of the Quran is literally unintelligible. He says every fifth part of it, about 20%, is literally untranslatable because it's just unintelligible. The Arabic is just not clear what it means. So I would think that compared to other sacred texts, the New Testament is in very, very good shape in having a text which is about 99% accurate to what the original actually said. How about this fellow right down here in the second row? The question was, he has heard that the preface to the Gospel of Luke, someone has suggested it's a later insertion made to make the Gospel look more credible. I don't know of any manuscript evidence for that. This would be a good example of where, if you're going to say something wasn't part of the original, you need to have some kind of manuscript evidence to suggest that this is called an interpolation. And I don't know of anything like that. It fits right in with the preface to the book of Acts, where he also addresses Theophilus, this apparently nobleman for whom the Gospel and the Acts are written, and he says, most excellent Theophilus, in the first book I explained to you all that Jesus said and did, and now I'm going to go on. So in the book of Acts, it seems to correspond with the preface of the Gospel of Luke, and that would suggest, I think, that it was original. And in any case, whatever you think of the preface, as I say, the historical reliability of Acts has been confirmed in enormous detail, as Colin Hemer shows in his book, The Book of Acts in the Setting of Hellenistic History. Okay, way over here. Yes, I'll just repeat, and then the question was, is he correct in understanding we don't have what are called the autographs, that is to say, the actual manuscript that Paul or Peter or John penned? What we have are copies and reconstructions of the original text. Yes, that's right. All right. Well, first of all, with respect to the question about the gap, as you put it, between the original autograph and our reconstructions, that was the question that I addressed to the young lady previously. Scholars, textual critics, have reconstructed the original text of the New Testament with 99% accuracy. So the only gap that remains now is that 1%, about 1,400 words out of 138,000 words, and they are basically trivialities. It affects no Christian doctrine. So that's all the gap that's left now, which textual scholars are continuing to work on. And those words are out there in the variants. I mean, we have these various readings, so it's not as though it's been lost. It's there, and they need to determine which is the right reading for this 1% that remains. Now, with respect to the Gospel of Matthew, for example, and the Trinitarian formula in the Great Commission where he says, go into all the world and make disciples of every nation, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Again, even if we think that this represents a kind of advance in Trinitarian theology, and Matthew's paraphrase, say, of what Jesus said, nevertheless, this is part of the original Gospel of Matthew. You can't say that this was added in the second or third century later, because this is part of the original Greek text of Matthew's Gospel. So, pardon me. To say that the Gospels are historically accurate in the way I described isn't to exclude the idea that they use paraphrase or that they give back in their own words what Jesus said. After all, we're talking about a culture in which the device of quotation marks was not even known. There wasn't any such thing as even quotation marks. So I think we ought to allow, in accord with other ancient historians, the gospel writers, the freedom to paraphrase and give back in their own words what Jesus said. And a case like this would be perhaps a case in point. But the points that I've focused on tonight aren't affected by that, because I have looked at the core claims and core events of the Passion narrative and resurrection, which aren't affected by paraphrase and subtle wording or something of that sort. Yes, let's go over to this side and take this lady's question. Yes. Right. The question was, in Judaism, there wasn't a concept of Messiah dying, much less rising from the dead. And she asked, well, what about the prophecies of this? There are prophecies in the book of Isaiah concerning the suffering servant of God, which probably Jesus read and applied to himself. But those aren't messianic prophecies. There, the suffering servant in the immediate context is Israel. And this is not described as the Messiah. If you look at Jewish literature prior to the time of Jesus, you will find nothing in messianic expectations that Messiah, instead of conquering Israel's enemies and restoring the throne of David in Jerusalem, is going to be killed by his enemies and humiliated as a criminal. There's just nothing like that in antecedent Judaism. And as for the resurrection, the resurrection was something that was supposed to happen at the end of the world. This is what the martyrs looked forward to, that even though they may give their lives now, ultimately God will raise everyone from the dead and they will be reunited in God's kingdom. So Jesus' predictions of his own death and resurrection, if he made such predictions, would have only confused the disciples. And in fact, when you look at the Gospels, it's evident that they didn't understand them. For example, Jesus says the Son of Man must be crucified and rise again. And the disciples say, well, why must Elijah, or won't Elijah come first? And what they were referring to was a Jewish tradition that Elijah the prophet would come back before the end of the world, at the day of judgment, and reappear on the scene. And so they're obviously thinking of the resurrection at the end of the world. Similarly, in John's Gospel, when Jesus says to Martha about her brother Lazarus, who has died, your brother Lazarus will rise again, what is her response to Jesus? She says, yes, Lord, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. She has no inkling that he's about to bring Lazarus back to life. So if Jesus did make these sorts of predictions, they would have been bewildering to the disciples, given their Jewish frame of thinking. And moreover, what one also needs to keep in mind is that if you do accept that Jesus made such prophecies of his death and resurrection, then you cannot deny the historical reliability of the burial, empty tomb, and appearances, because the latter are far better attested than the former. That is to say, if you accept the evidence for the prophecies of his death and resurrection, then you need to accept as well the even more strongly attested narratives of his burial, empty tomb, and resurrection appearances. Yes, right here, this fellow. The original Gospels don't contain anybody's name on them. The titles aren't part of the original document. So the authors don't identify themselves by name. But it must be said that these ascriptions of authorship are extremely early. They are first century. These are not author titles that arose later in the second century. So that the external evidence that these authors are correctly attributed to the various Gospels is very strong, I think. What leads many scholars to doubt the attributed authorship would be internal evidence. They think, for example, that the Gospel of John could not have been written by John. And so since the author is not identified, there's speculation that it may have been somebody else. But these internal factors tend to be extremely subjective, and I think that one is safer in going with the preponderance of external testimony by first century sources about the authorship. But in fact, nothing really hangs on that. Take the Luke, for example. It doesn't matter whether this author's name was Luke or Joseph or Amos or whatever it might have been, Theophilus, it doesn't matter what the author's name was. What we can tell based on the internal evidence is that he was a traveling companion of Paul who accompanied Paul on these apostolic journeys around the Mediterranean and finally back to Jerusalem and was therefore in a position to interview eyewitnesses just as he says. So the actual names of the authors, I don't think, is really all that important. What is important is whether or not these narratives stand up to the tests of historical reliability. And I think that in general they do. Yes, this fellow here. Yeah. Well, the question at first was with respect to mystical teachings of Jesus. Without knowing what the book was that you're reading, I really can't comment on that, except to say watch out for that pattern that I described from Luke Johnson of books claiming that Jesus offered some sort of mystical teachings that are at odds with the teachings that are attested in the four Gospels, which are our primary source documents. As for being born in a cave, that is an old tradition based upon the idea that animal shelters, such as was described in the case of Jesus' birth, may have been in a cave, in the rock. Excuse me? A metaphor for the womb. Yeah, I don't think that sounds to me like, based on what you said about mystical teachings, that somebody is trying to read things in between the lines that just aren't there. I mean, it says nothing in the Gospels about Jesus being born in a cave. This is an extra-biblical tradition based on the idea that animals may have been sheltered in sort of caves, and so since Jesus was laid in a manger, he must have been in some sort of a cave. But there's no suggestion this is a metaphor for a womb or anything of that sort. Before we can read in between the lines, we need to learn to read the lines. And some scholars actually think that Jesus may have really been born in a house. You see these kind of homes even in Switzerland today, where the stable and the house are really all under one roof, and that Jesus may have been born in the home of a sort of Palestinian farmer where the animals occupy one part and with the fodder and the hay and so forth, and then the family occupies another part, and it's all under the same roof. So that, in fact, he wasn't born in some sort of a stable out back of an inn. So that would be another possibility. But these are really all speculations that go beyond what the text says and though interesting, I think, don't represent much other than conjectures. Yes. Yes. The question was, Richard Dawkins has said that how can you criticize the Da Vinci Code as being fictional when the Gospels are just as fictional? Well, I think with all due respect, that just illustrates Richard Dawkins' ignorance of New Testament historiography. The fact is that the Gospels today are regarded as serious sources for the life of Jesus, and that we can know a good deal about the historical Jesus who actually lived and wrought. And I mentioned tonight some of the things that most scholars would agree are characteristic of the historical Jesus. And that is just a league away from the sort of speculations that Dan Brown offers in the Da Vinci Code, which are based upon these later apocryphal gospels, as well as a good deal of artistic imagination. So Dawkins is a fine biologist, but he's by no means a New Testament scholar or historian, and therefore his opinions should be taken, I think, with a grain of salt in that regard. Yes, this fellow over here. Yeah. The question was, there's obviously a lot of doubt concerning these things, so if there is an all-powerful God, why wouldn't he leave indisputable evidence of his existence? Well, this is a very good question, I think. Raising Jesus from the dead might seem to be indisputable evidence. This has never happened before in history. It's never happened since. This would seem to be extraordinarily good evidence that God is acting in history. But by its very nature, as a historical event, it will eventually be no longer in the lifetime of the eyewitnesses, and we will be reliant upon historical testimony to that event. And although the records we have to that are good and establish, I think, the historicity of the events I described, comparable to other events in ancient history, nevertheless, they don't make it indisputable. N.T. Wright, in his book, has said that the events of the empty tomb and the appearances of Jesus have such a high degree of historical probability that they are comparable to the death of Caesar Augustus in A.D. 14 or the fall of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. Now, for me, if that's true, that's good enough. You don't need to establish that these things occurred indisputably. You need to establish that they have comparable historical credibility to other events in ancient history which are widely accepted by open-minded and rational persons today. But nevertheless, the point remains, it's not indisputable. And I think God could have given indisputable evidence of his existence if he had wanted to. For example, he could have put a label on every atom that said, made by God. Or he could have planted a neon cross in the sky that says, Jesus saves. So that everyone would know that he exists indisputably. And obviously God hasn't chosen to do that. And as a Christian thinker, I ask myself, well, why? Why has God not made his existence indisputably obvious? Why are we created, as it were, a sort of arm's length so that one can doubt this and it's not indisputable? And it occurs to me that according to the New Testament, God isn't really all that interested in getting people to believe that he exists. I think that it's really a matter of relative indifference to God whether or not people believe that he exists. Rather, what God is interested in, according to the New Testament, is having a personal love relationship with people. And getting people to believe that he exists is a far cry from people coming into that kind of personal relationship of love and trust. In fact, the Bible says the demons believe that God exists, and they tremble because they have no saving relationship with God. So getting people merely to believe that God exists is actually relatively unimportant. What's important is that people come to know God and to believe in God, not just believe that God exists. And if that's the case, then I think it's not at all improbable that God has given sufficient evidence of his existence to convince persons with an open mind and an open heart, but which will not compel people whose hearts are closed. And God has given not only external evidence, but also the inner evidence of the witness of His Holy Spirit. Jesus said, if any man's will is to do God's will, he will know whether my teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority. So that I think that God has given evidence which He knows is effective in bringing people into this saving relationship with Himself who would freely come to it. And if God were to make His existence starkly evident by inscribing His name on every atom or creating a neon cross in the sky, I see no reason at all to think that more people would come to know and love Him and come into a saving relationship than actually do. Even if more people came to believe that He exists, I see no reason at all to think that more people would come to know Him and love Him in this saving way. You look at the Old Testament, a story of miracles and manifest wonders of God. The people of Israel saw the pillar of smoke by day and the pillar of fire by night. Did that lead to lasting heart change in the people? No. Israel fell into apostasy over and over again with tiresome repetitiveness. Mere miracles, mere shows of His existence won't bring people into a loving and trusting, saving relationship with God. So I don't see any reason to think that making His existence indisputably evident would be any more effective in bringing people to know Him than what God has already done in this world. In fact, when you think about it, in a world in which there was a neon cross in the sky or God's name on every atom, people might begin to chafe under a while and to resent these brazen advertisements of the Creator rather than come to love and know Him. So I think that God has done all that is necessary to bring the maximum number of people into a saving relationship with Himself who are willing to come. And He has no obligation to do anything beyond that. Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay. The question is, what about contradictions in the New Testament? And he gives an example that Jesus identifies John the Baptist as Elijah. But John the Baptist, when asked, said, no, I am not Elijah. Let me say, first of all, I don't think that's a contradiction at all. That just shows differing perceptions, that John didn't have a perception of himself as Elijah, but that Jesus, having greater insight into God's prophetic plan for human history, says, in effect, John the Baptist is Elijah. Come again. But nevertheless, with respect to contradictions, an honest observer would have to say there are things in the New Testament records that we don't know how to reconcile. The death of Judas would be a better one. Exactly how did Judas die is not clear in the New Testament narratives. And what I would say in cases like this is that one just suspends judgment. You just say, I don't have the adequate historical information in order to explain this, but nothing of any significance hangs on that. In particular, none of the aspects of the life and teachings of Jesus that I mentioned tonight would depend upon that. So I am not trying to prove biblical inerrancy tonight. I think that is an in-house debate among Christians. That's a theological debate. I think that all that one needs to show in order to make faith in Jesus rational is the fundamental historical reliability of these documents, not their inerrancy or infallibility. Yes, way up in the back. Yeah. No, the Qumran Dead Sea Scrolls don't do anything to undermine biblical reliability. On the contrary, the scroll of the book of Isaiah shows that the Jews were incredibly meticulous and careful in transmitting these texts, and shows how carefully they were copied, because the Isaiah scroll, which is hundreds of years earlier than the previous manuscript we had of Isaiah, is almost identical to the one that we had. So that it shows how carefully these documents were transmitted and copied by Jewish scribes. In terms of New Testament significance, the Qumran documents represent the writings of a tiny monastic sect called the Essenes, which had no direct contact with the events or persons mentioned in the New Testament. The only thing that it does is to help provide some of the more general cultural backdrop for the New Testament documents, to help us understand the multiplicity of Jewish sects that existed at the time of Jesus. And so it's valuable in terms of background studies, but it doesn't really impact in any direct way the documents of the New Testament. There is one very interesting feature, though, that one might mention in one of the Qumran scrolls. It talks about when Messiah comes, the dead will be raised. And this is very interesting because in Jesus' response to John the Baptist, when John said, "Are you the coming one? Are you the Messiah? Or should we look for another?" Jesus answered by saying, "The poor have the good news preached to them. The lame are healed." And he says, "And the dead are raised." And previously, we had no understanding of where that sort of idea came from. But from the Qumran documents, we know now that there was an anticipation within Judaism that Messiah would bring people back to life from the dead. And so this actually helps to make that reply to John the Baptist all the more understandable and to reveal again Jesus' messianic self-consciousness. So in that respect, there's a kind of indirect shedding of light on one of the sayings of Jesus found in the Gospels. Yes? Mm-hmm. The question was, what about the Gospel of Judah that has recently been in the press, and the fact that many other Gospels were discarded in the process of forming the New Testament? Well, I've already spoken in my talk to that last issue. These supposed Gospels that were discarded were these apocryphal Gospels, these forgeries that arose in the second half of the second century after Christ, and then later into the third and the fourth century and so forth. These were never considered as serious competitors to belong in the New Testament because everybody knew they were fakes. They were forged under the apostles' names, and they served as vehicles for Gnostic teaching. The Gnostics were a sect, a philosophical sect in the second century and beyond, which thought of the spirit as good and matter as evil, and they tried to piggyback on the Christian movement, much in the way Christian cults do today, and use Jesus as a mouthpiece for Gnostic doctrine. But everybody knew these were fakes, and so there was never any question of including them in the New Testament. The four Gospels came from the first century during the lifetime of the eyewitnesses, and everybody agreed as to their authenticity. The only question about forming the New Testament was not whether there were some books left out that should have been included. The only question they wrestled with was, are there some of the books that are included that should have been left out? For example, some early church fathers expressed some doubts about the authorship of the book of Hebrews, and others questioned 2nd and 3rd John, for example. And there was some debate, are these documents that really ought to be included? But there was never any debate about there are other letters, other documents that ought to be included. They erred on the side of including more things rather than excluding too much. Do you see what I mean? And similarly for the Gospel of Judas. The Gospel of Judas is a Gnostic text in which Judas is the sort of anti-hero. Many of these Gnostics liked the anti-heroes of the Bible, people like Cain, and others who were in rebellion against the God of the Old Testament. And so Judas served as a kind of convenient anti-hero for this Gnostic sect. And so you have Gnostic doctrine propagated in this. But it has absolutely no value in terms of an authentic source for the life of Jesus or the real Judas who actually betrayed Jesus. Go over here again. Yes. Okay, why was 2007 years before present the right time for Jesus to come? Actually, Jesus didn't come 2007 years ago. Our calendars are off by several years because of a switch midway through. Jesus was probably born around 4 BC or so. So there was no year zero. It wasn't exactly 2007 years ago. But the question was, why was this the time for him to come? Well, of course, one can't read God's mind. But what one can say, as the Apostle Paul said, is that in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son to be born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem mankind. And certainly Jesus did come at a propitious time in human history. There was the Pax Romana, that is to say the Roman peace, that ensured peace throughout the Mediterranean basin. That facilitated the spread of the gospel, as well as the Roman roads, which also helped to facilitate the spread of the gospel. Judaism was looking for a Messiah, so the ground was laid there. And so in many ways, this was a propitious time for Jesus to be born and for the gospel to spread. But beyond that, I don't see how one can answer the question as to why God chose that exact moment in human history, except that in his sovereignty, this was the fullness of the time, and now is the moment to bring Christ into the world. And it certainly has become the most successful, largest movement in the history of mankind, spreading in just 20 centuries from an obscure Palestinian hillbilly to a worldwide religion that at least one-third of the globe claims adherence to today and permeates virtually every sector of the populated globe. It's the hugest, most successful movement in the history of mankind. So clearly, if you do believe that this is under God's sovereignty, Christ came at the right moment in history to make the maximal impact upon human history.